Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm so happy to be back with you all. Last week I was away. I was traveling. I had a wedding, believe it or not, in Finland, which was a great excuse to visit a friend I had met at a slow food conference years ago. He is chef of a famous restaurant called Vincent's. His name is Chef Martins, and he runs the most fanciful, delicious restaurant I think I've ever been to. It's in Riga, in Latvia, and this restaurant was just so much fun. Every dish was a fantasy, a story behind it. We started with a basket of, a planter on the table, which was described as a walk in the woods. And every walk in the woods, you can always forage something and find something to eat in the forest. And so in amongst these sprigs of pine and fern were pastries that looked like antlers dispersed amongst the ferns for us to taste and start our meal with. Then he got caught in the middle of a hailstorm, and he caught one of the hail eggs and brought out, I swear it was, looked like an ostrich egg, but all ice, hollow inside. And then he came around, the chef actually would come to the tables, came around and with a little torch, melted away part of the upper part of the ice egg. And inside were two mini cannellini rolls. They looked like little nori rolls wrapped with crab meat and avocado that were just delicious. And every dish was that kind of fun story behind it, fanciful deliciousness. It was all seasonal. It's really, it was really an experience. So if you ever find yourself in Latvia, in Riga, definitely check out this restaurant, Vincent's. It was an A++, 4-star in my book. Really wonderful. And the chef is just so much fun. He goes around to all the tables and welcomes everybody and participates, and all the waiters and waitresses. It's a participatory experience, so it's really, really fun. But I missed being here with all of you, and I'm glad to be back. There's a couple petitions that I posted this week on my website that I would like you all to sign on at iegreen.com and put your name onto this petition. One is to say no to GMO salmon. I know we've talked about that a lot. It's getting really scary. It's getting very close. Some groceries have said they refuse to sell GMO salmon, but the two biggest, Walmart and Publix, are still not committed to saying no to selling GMO salmon. And so we're asking you to sign a petition to Walmart and Publix to let them know that we do not want GMO salmon hitting our shelves. So please sign that. Also, we've talked a lot about glyphosate. It is the main ingredient in Monsanto's Roundup. And the EPA, believe it or not, is still using Monsanto's testing to come up with a statement that says not likely to be carcinogenic to humans. They have not done their own testing. There is no proof that it's not harmful. There is a lot of studies that suggest it is harmful. We certainly know it's harmful to the bees. We just need to get it banned. So please sign that petition as well. And then in the news, a really exciting thing. There's a floating food forest set sail in New York this summer. That should be really fun. It's called Swale, and it's a big barge that will be sailing on New York waterways this summer, filling, going to different areas that might not have access to really good food. And the idea is that food is a basic human right, not a commodity. And all the food grown on the barge will be given away free, and it's all grown sustainably. And it's really should be exciting. So keep your eyes open for Swale and see where it sets sale and where it lands, and check it out. And then also just food waste. We keep talking about food waste. It is really getting a lot of attention. Americans throw out 70 billion tons of food every year. And I'm guilty of that, too. I really try not to. I compost, I recycle. But there's still all those scraps or the food that I didn't get to eat that's in the refrigerator that I end up throwing away, and I'm really, really trying to focus on it. So we're just asking everybody to really become aware of the crisis around food waste and how many people could be fed with food waste. There's actually an app to help people connect with food waste. If you have leftover food, you can go to this app and connect. I don't have it on the top of my head right now, but I will share it with you again next week. So, I'm sure if you Google, you know, an app for food waste, you will come up with it. Of course, there's Ample Harvest, which is also an app to help gardeners, all of us who are growing food. If you have extra food in your garden and you want to donate it to a food pantry, Ample Harvest is a wonderful app and website that you can go and connect to food pantries that will accept that food. And so that's a really nice way you can help out as well. So lots of events are going on in and around the city. I want to start by telling you this weekend I am joining with my daughter Ilana Mehta to bring a women's retreat to the IE Green Homestead here in Old Westbury. And it is going to be kind of like the yoga workshops I've had, except my daughter teaches a dance type of movement that connects with the different elements and everyone's feminine energy within, male or female. However, this is just a women's event, so guys, you'll have to wait till next time. But it just should be getting in touch with your primal energy as it relates to the fire, earth, water, air, wind, and we're going to move through it. And then it will be followed by a cooking class where I'm going to do some grilled stuffed portobello mushrooms, some Thai summer rolls, my lemon raspberry vegan cheesecake. So it should be really a wonderful day, and of course we'll end it by sitting down to a farm-to-table meal all together. So come and join us for that. Unfortunately, the June 5th farm tour that we were doing with the Long Island Food Coalition has been canceled. We just didn't have enough people to fill the bus to justify the cost. So unfortunately, it's been canceled for now. Hopefully, it's just postponed and we will do it later in the year. I think it also is just a bad time of year. Everyone has graduations and weddings and just a busy time of year. But keep your eyes open at the Long Island Food Coalition to find out if that's rescheduled. We are sticking with our Rodale Institute event, which is on a Monday, July 18th. We'll be taking a bus to the Rodale Institute in Kutztown, Pennsylvania. Leaving early in the morning, we will do a tour of the farm, have lunch, and then do an organic agricultural workshop as well. So it's a full-day event, and that should be really great. And you can register at the Long Island Food Coalition website. A couple other things that are going on that is exciting. This next week on Tuesday, Slow Food North Shore is partnering with the Cinema Arts Center, which is our partner when we do our film festivals. We are going to be screening the film Inhabit, which is a wonderful film about permaculture and the ecological design model for solving issues on our planet. And so the filmmaker, Costa Boutsikaris, will be joining us. And it should be really a great event. And, of course, following the screening, we will have a slow food reception. So I hope you can join us for that. And also on June 12th, we are going to be celebrating Rising Tide Natural Market, their 40th anniversary. If you're anywhere on Long Island, it should be fun. They're going to be lots of giveaways, great food, music, and they are our Slow Food North Shore's latest snail of approval establishment. They are really committed to sustainability, to organic, to nutrition, health, really in a very positive way, and they have been a staple establishment in this community for 40 years, really way before Whole Foods ever existed, And we're going to go out and have a table there, Slow Food North Shore, and celebrate them. So if you are around, come down to that. July 8th through 17th, this is the Long Island Food Truck Rodeo, and that's going to be taking place in Southampton Elks Lodge. And that's just, 10 days of food and fun. Should be quite an event. So if you are out on the east end of Long Island, check that out. And then the Sylvia Center, which is a wonderful nonprofit on the Lower East Side, they have a farm upstate in Kinderhook called Catchkey Farm. They will be having their farm-to-table benefit dinner on July 23rd. That's always a great event. If you can get out to that, that would be wonderful. So I want to share with you my recipe for the week. This week, the recipe is a Mediterranean spring medley, and it's delicious. I use brown rice pasta with it, but you can really use any pasta of your choice, or you could even use rice or quinoa if you prefer. I start with one organic onion cut in half and then sliced into crescent moons, 10 cloves of garlic chopped fine, 2 to 3 organic portobello mushrooms sliced into 1-inch pieces, 2 cups of sugar snap peas, 1 can of cannelloni beans, 2 cans of fire-roasted tomatoes, 1/2 teaspoon thyme, 1 teaspoon oregano, 2 tablespoons of white wine, 1 tablespoon of small capers, 1/4 teaspoon red chili flakes. That's optional if you don't like spice, but it just gives it a little bit of a bite to it. 1/4 cup of organic Kalamata olives, sliced. 1/4 cup chopped fresh tomatoes. 1/4 cup chopped Italian parsley, stems removed. 2 cups cooked organic brown rice fusilli pasta. Salt and pepper to taste, olive oil, and fresh parsley to garnish. So you're going to start by covering the bottom of a medium-sized cast iron pan with olive oil. And when the oil's hot, add the onions. Let that cook for a few minutes, then add the garlic. Continue cooking at medium-high heat, stirring constantly for about 5 minutes. Then add the portobello mushrooms. Cook those down for a few minutes. Then add the white wine, the thyme, the oregano, and the red pepper flakes if you're using them. Cook that at a high heat for a few more minutes. Then add the sugar snap peas, the cannelloni beans, the fire-roasted tomatoes, the olives, and capers. Mix that up. Add the already cooked pasta. Add the fresh chopped parsley and the fresh tomatoes. And just let that, mix it up and just let the heat from everything just slightly cook the tomatoes, but really just slightly. And then take it off. You want to do it before the sugar snap peas overcook. I didn't have asparagus, but this dish really would benefit also from some asparagus, which are delightfully in season right now. So if you have some, you can add that as well. And like with all my recipes, if you don't have all the ingredients, it's okay. You can wing it. You can adjust it. You can put in what you have in the house. Do not, decide that you can't make a recipe because you're missing an ingredient. You can always substitute something else. Everything's flexible. If you don't like something, you can always leave it out. That's the beauty of being a chef. You can adjust things to your own taste. So now it's my pleasure to introduce to you my guest this week. Michael Phillips is a farmer, writer, carpenter, orchard consultant, and a speaker who lives at Hartsong Farm in northern New Hampshire, where they grow organic apples and a variety of medicinal herbs. And as someone who's trying to grow apples organically, when I found Michael, I was just so excited to be able to bring him on and let him share some of his knowledge with all of you there. So it's my pleasure to introduce Michael to all of you. Michael, you with me? Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm good. I was out mowing. I kind of forgot about this interview, so we timed it well. It worked.
Good. I'm so glad. Wonderful. So before we really get into the interview, maybe you could just share a little bit of your background with my listeners. How did you come to become an organic apple grower or holistic apple grower?
Well, we all have a path in life, and sometimes we bumble along figuring out what we really want to do and who we are. And I grew up in southeastern Pennsylvania. Actually, I heard you mention you're going to Rodale, and my grandparents' farm was just over the hill from there. And when you guys are there, you'll see the bookstore, and that's where my aunts and uncles went to school in a one-room schoolhouse. Anyway,
Really?
That was my background. I got a degree in civil engineering from Penn State, and I did it for 10 months, and then I retired at age 23 and
so you
headed
made
north.
So much money?
Not much money, but a lot of idealism. But
uh-huh.
in heading north, I ended up at a home for abused and abandoned children, and I became the gardener, and I planted apple trees, and I found that I loved having my hands in the earth and working with plants and with all the insects and particularly trees. And as I got more and more into the trees, I just started to realize there were other things we needed to do than just spray, whether it was chemicals or organic. I always did it organically, but I knew there was a much deeper story there. And I married my wife, Nancy. We found our farm in the far north part of New Hampshire. We're about 30 miles from the Canadian border, and been growing here for about 25 years now. And in sharing with other growers and just really learning about plants and about the fungi in the soil and the whole realm of insects and how it all comes together, there's a fascinating story to tell. And that's really basically what became my books, The Apple Grower mm-hmm. and The Holistic Orchard.
Mm-hmm. And you use the word holistic as opposed to organic. Can you share with us what the difference is in that? What makes the difference between holistic or organic?
Well, just like our bodies have immune systems, and if we're eating a good diet and getting the right amount of sleep and all that, our immune systems are strong. Similarly, plants have an immune function, and they have an ability to repel disease and make themselves less attractive to insects by basically just being outrageously healthy and robust. So when I speak in terms of managing the orchard holistically, I'm all about what are the nutritional and biological things I can do to make this tree stronger. Now, in organic, some of that takes place, but there's kind of been a shift from kind of the same thinking that went into chemical growing with what I'll kind of call the base level organic, where you just use more natural sprays to deal with the pest or the disease symptom. I'm coming at it from the other approach where I make the tree so strong that it doesn't show the disease symptom or have the same kind of insect problems as trees that are not quite as robust.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. Now, is that similar to biodynamics? I know, you know, they use different soil preparations to make the soil more nutritional for the plants. Is it somewhat similar, or are you working with different elements than biodynamics?
I weave in some biodynamic teachings into what I do. It's definitely similar with respect to try to do things within the circle of the farm and also work with the soil biology and the big picture of all the life forms that are out there. I get into some specific sprays, you know, so I do spray, but in my sprays are things like seaweed, fatty acid containing things like liquid fish and neem oil, and then also a probiotic formulation of effective microorganisms. And all of this contributes to the nutritional and biological aspects of health of the plant. So yes, I weave in some biodynamics, I weave in some organics, and kind of a lot of herbalism, which my wife Nancy is an herbalist, that I've learned from her.
Mm-hmm. So what do you find typically is lacking in most soil? Is there anything particular that you found in your years of experience that is really needed that is usually lacking?
Well, it really all comes down to soil life and diversity of soil organisms. And one of the big ones is mycorrhizal fungi. Mycorrhizal fungi have an association with the roots of 90% of the plants on our planet. So they're pretty normal and meant to be there. But a lot of the things that we do, typically in agriculture, deplete the mycorrhizal fungal connection. So these are fungi that bring the plant nutrients and help protect it from disease and stimulate its immune function, many, many good things. But when we spray fungicides to deal with fungal disease up in the tree, and those fungicides drip down to the ground, and these can be chemical fungicides, these can be organic fungicides like copper and sulfur, they kill the good fungi as well as the problematic fungi. And so when trees don't have that affiliation, or most plants, they don't have the same ability to get nutrients from as far. They're not connected through the mycorrhizal network, where these fungi actually kind of have this internet going on underneath the ground, connecting tree to tree and plant to tree and tree to plant. Amazing things that take place. And we have just, more often than not, screwed that up. And that's point number one. That's where you begin. Let's reestablish that connection with soil biology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took a workshop, and I was shocked when they were saying, you know, like, people who are doing organic in a neighborhood somewhat like me, you know, I might not be putting any chemicals down in my garden, but if my neighbor is, that fungi interconnectedness that you're talking about is, you know, connected, you know, doesn't, goes right under the driveway, you know, that doesn't really stop it. And, you know, and I can get contamination from my neighbors, even if
wow.
I'm trying to do
organic.
Wow, I have
not thought of it quite that way, but maybe that's a possibility, but it's an amazing realm. I've just spent the last 6 months writing about it. It'll be a new book coming out at the end of this year with Chelsea Publishing.
What's that called?
I hope it's going to be called Soil Redemption Song, but we're in the deciding process.
Okay, well, when you figure it out, let me know, and I'll share it with my listeners.
Okay, I will.
Okay. So you do some spraying, but not chemical spraying, but it sounds like copper spray and sulfur spray also are killing the fungi. So what do you suggest people spray with? I know we want to replenish the soil, but if someone's dealing with something immediate, let's say, you know, they have, a borer or a fungal infestation, what do they do?
Well, a lot of what we need to do is preemptive. And that's kind of true for regardless of your approach to orcharding. It isn't like you can deal with it once it's established in terms of diseases. So when I talk about spraying fatty acids and microbes on the surface of the plant, what I am doing is creating a competitive colonization of that leaf surface, of those fruit surfaces. And when there's plenty of other beneficial microbes covering the plant, they take care of a disease organism landing in their midst, and it's pretty much they either eat it or maybe they create their own natural antibiotic, which takes care of the fire blight bacterium, or they consume the food resources before the disease organism can. It's a deep storyline. I try to break it down into kind of basic blocks. Another part of that is which disease are we talking about? So right now, apple scab is a big one. Scab makes those black, kind of dark lesions, and if it gets out of hand, can actually crack the fruit, and no one's going to be eating anything like that. And we're about to have rain on Sunday, so tomorrow I'm going to do another one of these sprays right before the rain event, and it's going to stimulate the immune function, the phytochemistry of the plant, and it's going to cover all the surfaces with plenty of hungry microbes that will be looking for disease organisms to dare come in their midst. And it's fun, too, because it's like I'm spraying seaweed. I'm spraying neem oil, which is pressed from a seed of a tree that grows in India, and it contains different fats and some other compounds, all of which help repel insects. And I'm spraying these effective microorganisms, which is a lot like if you go into the store and get probiotic formulation or you eat real yogurt with natural microbes in it. I'm just working with like kind of food concepts, basic food as medicine concepts.
That's great. You don't hear of that very often, thinking about food as medicine. We hear about in relation to our own health, but not so much in relation to the plants. So that's, you know, a great way of thinking about it. And so once the disease is established, it sounds like it's much harder to, like, I guess I'm beating around the bush, but I've been dealing with a borer on my peach tree for years now. You know, I've brought some people in. They say, well, I have the healthiest looking sick tree they've ever seen because I'm trying to do those things where I'm, you know, trying to you know, feed the soil, put lots of compost down. I made a biodynamic paste with diatomaceous earth and cow manure and clay, I think it was. You know, and I made this mixture and painted it all over the bark. And, you know, anyway, so I've been keeping this tree alive for at least 4 years now and still producing beautiful fruit. But, you know, from the bark, it's oozing this gelatinous stuff, which I've been told is a bore. Any suggestions?
So in the case of peach trees, stone fruit, the borers are one of two species of moths. And one favors the underside of branch crotches, and the other one works the soil line more often. And both of them have a certain window when they're in flight, which is pretty much now for the next month or so. And during that time, you can do things to try to repel them. So your idea with the biodynamic tree paste might have helped to a slight degree there.
Mm-hmm.
What I use is my higher concentration of neem as a botanical trunk spray. I'm not dealing with the peach borer, but I'm dealing with an apple borer, which is a beetle, but mm-hmm. it's kind of the same idea. Some compounds in the neem make it less likely that the insect will lay its eggs there. But if your peach tree is essentially the only peach tree within sight, they're probably going to be pretty persistent in terms of repellency. So another thing that's really helpful is coming in, I'd say mid-July, and in that mud pack of what biodynamic tree paste kind of is like, if you were to mix in some parasitic nematodes, which are little tiny organisms, soil organisms, that seek out insect larvae and pupa, they would actually go into those holes before too much damage was done and destroy the borer that's inside. And maybe over time, you would start to get a handle on the returning population by limiting how successful they were in your tree. But that's a question of what all's in the neighborhood and what else are they targeting. But those are the types of things I would be thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Now, the nematodes, you can spray those? Or how do you put them on?
There's a company called Arbico Organics, and they're, I think, in New Mexico, maybe Arizona. They're one of the sources. And, yes, it's there might be 15 million nematodes in the gallon of, or the quart of solution that you get, and then you dilute it with water. Usually you're going after soil insects that pupate in the soil, so there you'd use a watering can.
But yeah, I've used nematodes for dealing with my grubs in the lawn.
Yes, we're talking about the same thing.
Uh-huh,
but in this case with the peach tree and with the borer that's on the bark, I would put that solution of nematodes, kind of make a mud pack so that you create kind of a soil environment as you're going up the bark of the tree, and that will give them an opportunity to move into the bark tissue. Because we're taking them out of their environment, but if we make it kind of soil-like, they're going to be able to live and get in there and do what they need to do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm going to give that a try. Because everyone, you know, they just say, oh, there's nothing. You got to spray. And I'm like, well, I'd rather, you know, sacrifice the tree than spray. So I'm doing my best to keep it alive. And like I said, I've still been getting, you know, 4 huge bushels of peaches out of that tree every year. So... And they're delicious. They're unlike the kind you can get in the market, so it's great.
The other thing to add there is because this is a moth, that moth is attracted to the pheromone scent of the same species. You can get wing traps where that scent is placed in there, and it will capture most of the males. And if that's hung out at about the time of bloom, you'll maybe catch all the guys. And the females won't get impregnated. That's a hit-or-miss method. But that's another thing. Just because it's a moth, they're attracted to this sexual scent of themselves. We're able to mimic that and bring them into a sticky-coated trap.
Okay. I'll give that a try, too. So I know you live, like you said, so close to the Canadian border. That's colder than most most orchards are. Do you find that challenging, and how do you deal with the climate, and have you seen any changes with climate change in the 25 years you've been there?
Well, definitely things have changed in that we're having warmer winters, we're having a more extended fall. We used to see 40, even 50 below here when we first moved here, but now it tends to kind of plateau at around 20, 25 below. It's still a little too cold to grow a peach tree and count on it living year after year after year. In terms of the apples, though, this is a great climate for growing apples. There's a few really long season things like Granny Smith, which wouldn't be appropriate here because it would never have enough ripening time in the fall. That's something that really is going to ripen by Thanksgiving, and we will have had very cold nights by then. But on the other hand, I have about 120 varieties, so it's I don't really feel cut off.
You'll miss it.
There's a handful of apples I really shouldn't grow here. You know, every site, and it doesn't matter where you are, it's not so much about temperature, but every site has its challenges. And from high humidity in the southeast and the mid-Atlantic, you're going to see a lot more disease pressures. Where I have round-headed apple tree borer, there are places where they don't. And so we all pretty much would share codling moth. But other things will be more like at this site, but not at this site. And what orcharding is about is kind of fine-tuning this whole big mass of information and what looks like potential challenges to the actual things that are going on at your site. So you have peach borer, and that's affecting the vigor of the plant. I don't know if you have oriental fruit moth or codling moth, you know, but once you identify things or plum cuculeo, then there's things that you have to learn about their life cycle, and then you learn this is something I could do because this is that habit, the pattern of this insect, and it's a point of vulnerability. I can get at it.
Mm-hmm.
So I like living in the north because I like some semblance of winter yet, but it's kind of getting more and more balanced as things warm up overall in terms of our seasons being more even.
Mm-hmm. Well, 20 below is still freezing cold in my book. So one of the things that I've also heard about with apple trees is what comes onto the leaves from the spruce trees, you know, being close to the spruce trees. I'm forgetting the name of it, rust, or do you know what I'm talking about?
Okay, yes. So there is something called cedar apple rust. This comes from the eastern red cedars. So not the spruce tree, but the eastern red cedar. And it's a fungal disease that spores are blown into the wind when it rains, somewhere between the bloom of the apple and up to a month after. You know, there are a number of varieties that are rust immune. So anything in the Macintosh family lineage with those genes will not really get rust. Something like William's Pride, any of the russet apples. On the other hand, the holistic sprays are doing the same thing, competitive colonization, boost the immune function of the plant, but it's really about knowing the timing, how long you've got to keep that applications going, because that's the problem you have at your site.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would think you don't have it up there?
Well, Eastern Red Cedar does not grow where it gets to be 20 below, so there are advantages.
Lucky you, Good. Now, let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about your book, okay?
Okay,
everyone,
great.
Don't go away. I'm talking with Michael Phillips, author of The Holistic Apple Orchard. Be right back.
I am
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm here with my guest, Michael Phillips. He's the author of The Apple Grower. A correction, I called it the wrong name before. His book is The Apple Grower, and he is a holistic orchard consultant, and I'm so happy to have him on. Mike, are you with me again?
I am here.
Great. So I wanted to talk a little bit about your book. I know that in gardening, very often we hear about companion planting, but I hadn't really heard of it so much in terms of orchards. But in your book, you talk about some companion planting. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
So out in the orchard, the more diversity we have in the orchard ecosystem, and I mean somewhat under the trees and in the aisles, but the surrounding area, the more diversity, the more beneficial insects you're going to have, the more pollinators you're going to have. So some of the plants that I have around my trees have big taproots, things like comfrey, or even something humble like dandelion. And they're reaching down into the subsoil, bringing nutrients up into their leaves. When those plants are cut or they fall over, they make those nutrients become available on the soil surface. That's going to feed the apple feeder roots. So I like having that cycle of nutrition coming back to the tree. Any kind of flowering plant is going to provide adult habitat for beneficial insects. So when I talk about parasitic wasps, these tiny little braconid wasps, which are able to find the egg of a codling moth, and that egg is like the size of a pinhead. It's very small. You have more and more of those species if there's nectaries in terms of flowers for the adults to feed off of. And then they go find the eggs on the apple tree, and their little larva, in turn, destroys the potential pest. All because you've grown all kinds of flowering plants like sweet Sicily and Queen's Anne's lace in the vicinity of your garden. So if you have a vegetable garden going and you have some flowers and you have herbs in particular draw a lot of good pests. If you're growing some rhubarb, you know, let a few flower stalks rise up. A lot of times people will cut them off thinking they're going to keep the rhubarb stalks coming longer. But those flower stalks become like this whole new universe of beneficial insects that hover and gather the nectar and then go find pests, not just in your orchard, but things like tomato hornworm and cabbage moths are also part of the palate for beneficials. So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about orchard diversity and creating the right kind of habitat for good guys.
Mm-hmm. You know, I know you've probably heard a lot about in the news talking about, you know, the perfect fruit and everybody wanting, you know, the perfect fruit. And in Europe, I just came back, you know, there's this whole movement of the ugly fruit and promoting fruit that doesn't look perfect but might taste perfect. Do you see that shift happening here at all, or do you see the pressure for the perfect fruit still being, you know, predominantly what people are looking for?
So we all know the saying, an apple a day will keep the doctor away. And that was coined back in some point in the 1800s. Well, today, the truth of the perfect fruit is it really matters how we grow that fruit. And if we so over-medicate the fruit with fungicides and insecticides, so it is never stung, it never deals with the reality of the fact that out there in the sunshine, when it rains, fungal spores land on it, that fruit is going to be emptier medicinally. You know, maybe we have to eat 64 apples a day now just to get back to the saying because of the way most fruit is grown. But on the other hand, when that apple has to deter disease, produce certain phytochemicals so it can combat the way the disease is trying to penetrate into that skin, that in turn means that that apple is not only going to be more nutrient dense because of the way we grow it, but it's going to contain the phytochemicals that our bodies actually evolved with to help ward off degenerative disease. So the whole ugly apple movement, in a way, is about the fact that a spot or two, it doesn't have to be that ugly, but a spot or two, or just the fact that it's on the same tree where a few other apples got a spot or two, is just going to be that much more phytochemically nutrient-rich with the very things that our body needs to ward off disease. So when I see a spot on an apple, it's like, go wahoo, because those stress molecules are in there, and they're going to help me stay healthier.
Mm-hmm. That's a great way of thinking of it. And I've heard that a lot in our, in all the vegetables that we're growing, that stress actually, even in a flowering tree, I've heard, if it's a stressful season, it actually produces more flowers, or more fruit, that, the plant actually reacts well or beneficial for us, our benefit, when they get stressed. So it would be the same kind of thing.
Yeah, it would be like, I'll say the arugula, which always gets hit hard by flea beetles. And not that you have to eat like this totally ratty-looking green leaf to get the stress molecules, but when a plant experiences that damage, it sends chemical signals into the air, so surrounding plants receive that. But those same signals are sent by way of the fungal network to the far end of the row. And what you end up with is all the plants prime themselves with immune function, and so even the perfect-looking leaves that grow in a real environment are going to have these phytonutrients, and it's beautiful the way it all comes together when you see how nature designed it, and if we don't screw it up, we're back to that. Let's not screw it up.
Right.
And so many good things happen.
And in your book, you also talk about community orchards. Is that like a community-supported agriculture set up where you people are working together in your orchard, or how does that work?
So there was a time in this country when wherever people lived, people were trying to grow fruit and all the foods somewhat locally. Now we've lost that local food resource base in far too many ways, but in particular with fruit, where it was realized that when you grow out on the east side of the Cascade Mountain Range in Oregon and Washington, where they don't really have a lot of rain, they don't have a lot of disease problems. So suddenly we start growing all the fruit out there. Many orchards in the east and the Midwest and the South no longer can quite compete, and we lost a local food resource base. So my view is that we need to grow fruit to the degree that we can in all the places that we live. And I want to encourage people who maybe you start with 6 trees and you just think, this is a hoot. I'm having a good time. I could do more of this. And now you have 30 trees and you start selling some fruit at the local farmer's market. Maybe you're someone who has a small vegetable operation and you decide to add some fruit and you have an acre of trees. I have about 3 acres of apples here. I have friends with maybe 10 acres. But the fact that you're smaller scale and you're growing in places aren't maybe as perfect as Washington and Oregon in terms of fruit growing, it's important that people get encouraged to do that. And so a community orchard is a place where you're growing more fruit than you need for your family, and you're marketing it. And whether that's a very small part of your living or a significant part, as in my case, we just need more of that. And then people, in turn, have a chance to taste so many more varieties and taste fruit that's been properly tree ripened and support the circle of local economy, and that's all wrapped under that banner of community orcharding.
Mm-hmm. How much space does one apple tree need? Like, somebody who's thinking about wanting to maybe grow some apple trees, how much space does an apple tree need?
Well, just like there are thousands and thousands of varieties, every seed represents a new genetic system. And so over the course of time, there have been seeds that have grown into a smaller tree. And we reproduce the genetics of that tree to create rootstock. So if an apple is grafted onto a dwarf rootstock, that tree may need as little as a 3-4 foot radius around it. It's going to also need a stake, and it's going to be not quite as thrifty. It's going to need more coddling. A fuller size apple tree is going to need as much as 10, 15, even 20 feet radius around it. So that part of the question has to be determined. But, another thing you can do with apples that is amazing, let's say a room in your yard for one tree, and it's going to have a 10-foot radius, a 20-foot diameter. It's going to be that fairly good-sized tree, like a semi-dwarf. You can actually graft different varieties to create branches that all have a different variety than every other branch. And so you can have, I have a tree with 24 varieties on it. So you can have a lot of varieties on that bigger tree in your yard. On the other hand, if you have a nice wall where you can do an espalier pruning style on a two-dimensional plane, you can grow 5 or 6 different types of fruit in a span of about 24 feet with 5 or 6 different tree root systems involved. So there's a lot you can do, and there's a lot of options.
Mm-hmm. Where does one go to learn how to do that grafting, or do you buy it from somebody that's already done that?
Oh, there's a lot of groups and clubs that offer it. I mean, one of the ones near you, maybe not quite as near you, but in southeastern Pennsylvania, are the Backyard Fruit Growers. And they have a grafting workshop every spring. I do a few different farm organizations. The NOFAs often will host a grafting pruning workshop in the spring. It's not that hard to do. It sounds amazing that you can, like, take the finger off my left hand and graft it onto the finger on my right hand, and it will grow. And it doesn't really on people, but on trees, it does. I have various pictures and drawings in my books showing how it's done, and there's all kinds of grafting videos on YouTube, and it's just a question of diving in and giving it a try and then getting fascinated by it and learning a little bit of nuance, thinking about got to get those inner bark cells to match up, and this thing will grow and become a whole other variety of fruit on my tree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds fascinating. I actually did. I went to the food expo in Milan last year, and they had a whole row of apples with apple trees, you know, as a experiment, you know, or showing, you know, so many different types of apples on, you know, a few different trees. And it was amazing. It was amazing. Now, in your books, you also, you know, use certain terminology that is, you know, not what people are used to hearing, terms like competitive colonization, biological stew, fungal duff management, things like that. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the changes in language that you've used and why?
Well, if we're going to think biologically, we should have some terms that reflect what we're doing. So when I use the term fungal duff management, I want to get people to realize that they need to create a forest edge ecosystem underneath their trees. And by that, I don't necessarily mean that it's filled with raspberries and goldenrod, but that we have the kinds of organic matter, fungal foods, that are going to favor the fungi that are going to make our trees healthy. And that means things like fallen raspberry canes and branches that are chipped. When you prune your tree, you know, don't haul those prunings off to the landfill, but make them into smaller pieces and put them back into the soil. Think fungally. Think woodsy-type matter. When I say competitive colonization, you know, one of the things I ask in my workshops is, I'll point to someone and say, how many of me do you see right now? And the answer is one, but the truth is, biologically, I'm a community of 1 trillion beings, and all those different organisms, the bacteria on my eyeballs, covering my skin, my respiratory tract, my digestive tract, without them, I'd be like someone who goes into the hospital and is put on antibiotics. I'd be a sitting duck for a disease organism to take hold. So when I say competitive colonization, out there in nature, between the hot, drying sun and cold, freezing nights and acid rain, ultraviolet radiation, those microbes have a tougher job of staying in a steady state. We need to renew it, and that's where the effective microorganisms come into play. So all those terms are about just generating some buzz and excitement about thinking biologically, because that's what we need to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating to hear you speak in those terms, because I don't often talk to people who are, you know, in the garden. Yes, you know, people are talking more and more in a more holistic way about, you know, permaculture and biodynamics. But I guess I just haven't heard it much. Fruit trees. Every time I bring some organics person here to talk about the fruit trees, they talk to me about spraying, you know, even like you said, the copper, the sulfur, you know, which I haven't wanted to do. So it's, you know, that's why I was so excited when I found your book and found your website. And can you share with everybody your website? Because that's a fascinating place to peruse and look around. There's so much information right there.
Well, the website is www.groworganicapples.com, and it's kind of the center of a network of beyond organic, permaculture, biodynamic thinking type growers. You'll find listings for orchards in some parts of the country where growers have gotten involved. I share a number of articles about biological growing. It's pretty extensive, but it's offered to get people motivated and to realize, I can do this. This is something I can do.
Mm-hmm. And you've actually created like a community of holistic orchard growers through your website and your books, and that in itself is just so exciting, because, as you said, it's scattered around the country, and so many people can take advantage of that and learn from it and expand what they're doing. And I just you know, I'm really excited about it. So thank you, Michael.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Is there anything else that you'd like to add that I have not asked you that you think my listeners might be interested in hearing before we are out of time? We have just a couple minutes left.
Well, I just, you know, always come down to what does the fruit taste like? And when you start getting into this Apple Explorer thing, and whether that means connecting with someone who's growing in your area, or you learn to graft a few amazing varieties like St. Edmund's Russet and Ribston Pippin, you're going to be amazed at how big of a world of apple flavor, of, well, any fruit that's out there. And it's going to become the whole new motivation of, I want to do this. I want to be a part of this. And again, whether you want to grow trees or you want to support someone in your area who wants to do this, in the end, it's going to be the flavor that comes back to you, and it's going to just blow you away. And
right.
I always...
And the biodiversity, like you just are mentioning names. I mean, for years, people used to just think there was Red Delicious, Golden Delicious, Macintosh. When Granny Smith hit the market, it was like, whoa, a green apple. You know, I mean, this, and, you know, and we have the same thing with tomatoes. We have, you know, Vine Ripened, and we have Roma, and we have Beefsteak, and then and Cherry. You know, and there's... You know, as a slow food chapter leader and somebody so passionate about biodiversity in our food, there's just so many varieties that I think people don't even know about, myself included. And it's just, like you said, a whole world out there. So, Michael, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone out there, I've been talking with Michael Phillips, and you should definitely check out his website. Thanks, Michael.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Everyone out there, thank you so much for joining me. I will be with you again next week, and have a great rest of the week. Hope to see you this weekend at my workshop. Bye for now.